first topic is the difference between formal charge and oxidation state. So there's quite a bit of similarity between those two systems. And really, those are just two different systems for counting electrons. And the idea is this, that you can have a collection of atoms that individually each would have had a certain number of valence electrons in their unreacted natural elemental states. And as those atoms react to come together to form molecules, some atoms gain electrons, some atoms lose electrons. But, of course, the total number of electrons has to stay the same. And so that's what these two things, oxidation state and formal charge, tell us, which is how many electrons has an atom gained or lost as it's reacted. Why then do we have these two counting systems? Why don't we have just one? Well, it all has to do with the way that we perceive what a bond is. And you hopefully by this point know that we do have two diametrically opposed views of bonding. One of them is covalent bonding, in which the electrons are fully and completely shared between two different atoms. That's a model that we use quantum mechanics to describe, that we use orbitals to describe. So that's what we went through last quarter with bonds and antibonds and all that. And a perfect covalent bond would be one in which those electrons, again, are equally shared between the two atoms. There is, of course, however, the ionic bond, which would be similar, for those of you that were with me last quarter, to the classical description of a bond that we walked through. In other words, where we view the cations and anions coming together to form that bond as just little charges. And it's purely the attraction between those charges that's going to hold them together. So in other words, there's no orbital description there. It's purely based on electrostatics, plus and minus attracting each other. Well, reality is no one bond is completely covalent or one bond is completely ionic. For example, sodium chloride, which we usually think of as an ionic compound, does have some orbital description to it. The behavior of the atoms in that compound, it can be somewhat described using a covalent model. And then if you take the case of a molecule like water, where you have oxygen and hydrogen, there's so much electronegativity between those two atoms that they in fact cause an intra or intermolecular force known as hydrogen bonding, which is not really the formation of a bond, it's just a particularly strong dipole-dipole interaction. But that means there's this displacement of charge across the bond, so it's not really proper to call it purely covalent. And so we call it polar covalent. But then if we do get to the point where we want to know how many electrons really should be ascribed to each of the atoms in a molecule, well, how do we divvy it up? Do we look at it and say that we break each bond evenly? We pretend that they're covalent bonds. Or do we break each bond unevenly, where we give the electrons to the more electronegative element, which would be more like an ionic bond? And the answer is we do both. When we're drawing line structures, which are based on the idea that a molecule is held together covalently, then we use entirely formal charge. And formal charge is, in fact, where we view each bond as being evenly distributed. Not that the bonds really break, in either case. It's just our way of doing an accounting of the electrons. But therefore, when we encounter a bond, we give one electron from the bond to each of the atoms that are part of that bond. That's for formal charge. For oxidation state, we use that when we're doing redox reactions. And in that case, we treat everything as if they're ionic bonds. So between the two atoms in a bond, we look and see which one is more electronegative, and we give both of the electrons in that bond to the more electronegative atom. So that's the overview of the difference, and I also gave you a little bit of the similarity. So now let me write all this down. Formal charge and oxidation state are both counting systems for electrons, in which number of electrons around an atom in a molecule is compared to the number of electrons that atom would have had as an unreacted element. counting system to see whether atoms gained or lost electrons. The only difference between the two systems is how the electrons in a bond are distributed. So for let's do formal charge first. Formal charge views all bonds as purely covalent. And so one electron is given to each atom in a bond per bond. Meaning if you only have one bond, one electron goes here, one electron goes there. You have a double bond, two electrons, because you got two bonds. Two electrons go to one atom, two electrons go to the other. For the terminology that those of you who were with me last quarter are familiar with, this would be the same as if we approached each bond and broke it homolytically. Homolysis means to evenly break a bond. And in fact, when we went through the picture version of this last time, that's what we did. So, formal charge. Each bond is treated as if it's covalent. Meaning one electron is given to each atom in the bond, and that's per bond. And again, that is equivalent to undertaking homolytic cleavage. Oxidation state is where you treat each bond as being purely ionic. Each bond is treated as if it was ionic, which means that both electrons in the bond are given to the more electronegative element per bond. So if you had carbon-oxygen bond, if you had a single bond, oxygen would receive the two electrons from that bond. If you had a double bond, the oxygen would receive the four electrons in that double bond. I'm going to put a star right after that statement, which I'll address why very shortly. This process would be the equivalent of heterolytic cleavage of a bond. Which, one more time, it's not that bonds are really being broken this way in real life. This is our way of accounting for the electrons. Now, the star has to do with the situation wherein you have bond that has two of the same atom in it. And since neither atom would therefore be more electronegative than the other, we go back to considering it a covalent bond, which means, again, one electron goes to each atom in the bond. Now, when I've asked the different sections about the oxidation state of carbon, and we did review the oxidation of cyclododecanol into cyclododecanone, I'd asked what the carbon at the functional group point was in each case. And some of you said something along the lines of, oh, well, since there's an oxygen there, that's going to mean plus one on the carbon. It's a shorthand that I hadn't really discussed much before, but it does make it a lot more convenient than just having to redraw the molecule every single time. And so if you think of it this way, carbon is tetravalent, meaning it wants to have four bonds naturally. And if you think about carbon in almost all the molecules we ever see, it's got four bonds of some sort. Just like pentagens, like nitrogen, are usually trivalent. Think of ammonia. Chalcogens, like oxygen, they're usually divalent, something like water. And halogens, they're monovalent. So if we've got a carbon that's tetravalent, wants to have four bonds, then in this counting system under oxidation state, if we identify a bond as belonging to the other atom that's attached, if you have something that's more electronegative, like oxygen, chlorine, nitrogen, well, then that means there's an effective loss of electron from carbon, and so that means it's going to increase the oxidation state of carbon. So for each atom attached that's more electronegative, it causes a plus one oxidation state on carbon per bond. We write that out, and we're going to do a pictorial example in just a moment. But what I was saying is each atom that is more electronegative than carbon, and some of the common suspects in this would be nitrogen, oxygen, chlorine, bromine, will cause a plus one oxidation state on the carbon they are attached to, or it is attached to. And again, that is per bond. So have a single oxygen attack, you increase the oxidation state on carbon by one. You have a double bond oxygen, increase it by two. The reverse is true. If you had something that was less electronegative than carbon, then in that tug of war that we imagine happens for the purposes of counting oxidation state, carbon would effectively end up with an extra electron, which means it would count as a negative one towards the oxidation state of carbon. So if we had some two good examples are hydrogen and boron. If we had either of those, it would cause a negative one oxidation state on the carbon it is attached to. Or for those English majors out there, to which it is attached. If you had another carbon, well, then you treat it as a covalent bond, which means that you end up with exactly as many electrons as you should have. If you had carbon connected to four other carbons, the oxidation state would be zero. And so each carbon attached to a carbon has no effect on that carbon's oxidation state. So I'll say it this way. If one carbon is attached to another, then neither carbon causes any effective change on the oxidation state of the other. Now let's do an example where first we'll use these nice shorthand rules to tackle the molecule, and then we'll go back and do the drawing it out and manually breaking the bonds to find out really it's the same thing. Because every time we break the bond with oxygen, oxygen's going to get the electrons if we're talking about focusing on carbon. So let's look at the molecule butanal. We can see that we've got a double bond to oxygen, we have a single bond to carbon, we have a single bond to hydrogen. So starting on the left, the carbon that's attached, and we're going to only focus on the carbon that's part of the carbonyl. The carbon that it's attached to that carbonyl, what effect on oxidation state will that carbon have? None, because it's the same, so it's a zero effect. That's what you said, right? Oh, what'd you say? No, not the oxygen, the carbon. Right, but you would be right for the oxygen, that because of the oxygen having a double bond, it would cause the carbon to be plus two. What about the hydrogen? What would that cause on the carbon? Minus one. So we have zero over here, and then we have plus two because of the oxygen, and we have negative one because of the hydrogen. Zero plus two minus one gives us an overall plus one oxidation state on, again, just that carbonyl carbon I'm focusing in on. Now, the last time we talked about this topic, we manually went in to disconnect bonds to more formally count electrons. And what I want to demonstrate is that that's the long way of doing what these rules summarize. Again, because if you're talking about carbon, every time you have something more electronegative, the response is the same. Every time it's less, the same. So instead of doing the pictures over and over again, now that we've done it that way, that's why I'm comfortable using this set of rules. If I did want to rewrite that molecule, and again, focusing just on the carbonyl carbon, there's an oxygen around it, a hydrogen around it, and then another carbon. So with the carbon-carbon bond, each atom of that bond receives one electron because it's treated covalently. For the oxygen-carbon double bond, oxygen would get both pairs of electrons, leaving carbon with nothing. And then as far as the carbon-hydrogen bond, the both of the electrons that are on that bond would be ascribed to the carbon because it is more electronegative than hydrogen. Notice that that means that the carbon effectively has three electrons. Unreacted carbon, though, has four. If it's supposed to have four and it's missing one, that means it's charged. And that's how we get the same plus one oxidation state. So this is the difference between oxidation state and formal charge. And it stems from the fact that usually one bond in itself cannot be described purely as ionic or covalent. And so we carry both numbers to give a fuller picture of how that bond will react. Now, someone asked an interesting question in the first section. He was thinking of the molecule methane, CH4. And he said, oh, well, that means methane's going to be polar because it ends up with an oxidation state of minus 4. Well, yes, it has an oxidation state of minus 4, but you can't forget geometry. What's really going on there is each bond individually, yes, is going to be polar. And yes, the way we do oxidation state, you're going to end up with a large displacement of charge per bond. But remember that methane is tetrahedral. And so these dipoles that form are all symmetrically arranged. So, yeah, if you're sitting there at carbon, you're going to think, wow, I'm getting electrons from that one, from that one, from that one, from that one. But since it's equally getting it from all directions, from the outside, the molecule appears nonpolar. Questions on oxidation state versus formal charge. Since I think I'm speaking twice as fast as I normally do because of this meeting I just came out of, instead of taking the break quite yet, let's segue now into lecture on oxidation. If you need to take a break at some point, feel free. As soon as I'm done with this portion of the lecture, we will have our short break, and then we'll come back and talk about epoxides, and I'll also make some comments on what we're going to do on Wednesday. So this really, truly is lecture, 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 lecture. So if you do keep separate notes, switch to your lecture notes. What I'm about to present is on the quiz. Once I'm done with this, that is the end of the information for this first quiz. So oxidation. There are two main classes of reagents that we're going to discuss in this class. The one we'll do today is the chromium-based reagents, which is the earlier sections, for the most part, of the text that were quoted for the topic for oxidation. If you did read ahead, you hopefully read over something called the Swern oxidation, which I believe was in the latter part of your textbook. We are going to skip over that one today because with chromium reagents, there's a classic, how to say this? There's two types of behavior you could have using chromium reagents, particularly or in the case of primary alcohols. So in fact, that's where I'm going to start this discussion. Is the selective oxidation of primary alcohols. So, what we're going to find is in these different chromium oxidations, there are two main reagents that you're going to learn. One of them is normally used in anhydrous conditions. And so before I even start anything else off, let me tell you that for the selective oxidation, it is key that we have anhydrous conditions. So I scared the crap out of someone this morning because I got in the class, was getting set up, I looked over, she had several of her flashcards. I said, flashcards, flashcards. It's like, no, that's a good thing. You have your flashcards. But remember, there are these six aspects of a reaction that we're supposed to be learning. The synthetic utility, reagents, condition, mechanism, regiochemistry, stereochemistry. Well, this would be under the conditions that you must have an anhydrous environment. Now, with anhydrous environments, there's a particular reagent that's used. Pyridinium chlorochromate, PCC. That same reagent can be used in aqueous environments, but it's a waste. The only reason we use PCC is because it's a reagent that, in the absence of water, is able to do this selective oxidation. I'll make that statement again after I've shown you this, but I want to try to avoid confusion that often happens. It's not PCC per se that is itself magical. It's the combination of it and the fact you have no water that gets the result I'm going to show you. Now, this PCC thing, before I show you what that is, a little of nomenclature. This nitrogenous analog of benzene, where we've taken one of the carbons of benzene and substituted with a nitrogen, is called pyridine. When we get to amines, nitrogen-containing compounds, we're going to find that there's a zillion of these common names. We're going to learn a few of them, just a handful of molecules. But this is one of the main ones because it's so close to benzene. Most nitrogen-containing compounds are bases. The lone pair of a nitrogen is weakly basic. And so if pyridine is the neutral compound, then you can have its charged conjugate acid, which is called pyridinium. So that I-U-M ending is a very frequently used ending to mean cation. So the reagent is PCC, pyridinium chlorochromate. And that's all one word, technically, chlorochromate. What is chromate? Well, CrO4 minus
2.
Yes. Chlorochromate means replace one of the oxygens with a chlorine instead. So it turns out it's going to only be a minus 1 ion. You must know the name and the abbreviation and the structure for this reagent. Any reagent or solvent that I ever use abbreviations for, you need to know the name, the structure, and the abbreviation. Particularly because you might have a mechanism problem where you have to write where the electrons are going. In these kinds of problems, if there's any portion of the structure where you're able to abbreviate, then you must show the full structure once, and then you may use the abbreviation afterwards. And it's exactly what I'm going to do when I show you this example. So I'm going to take an alcohol. I'm going to set it up so we're going to start the oxidation, write the full reagent out once, and then the next step I'll show you how I abbreviate it. For my example, I'm going to use butane-1-ol. And here is the pyridinium chlorochromate. Now you got to be careful if you're in a hurry that you get your CR and your CL clearly identical from each other. It is chromium, not chlorine, that makes the center of this molecule. But it's not impossible to have a chlorine-centered molecule. Just pointing out, it is chromium here. What is the oxidation state of chromium in this case? Remember that oxygen is the second most electronegative element and fluorine is the most, so you can easily figure out between chromium and oxygen, and I'll just tell you that chlorine is more electronegative than chromium. Close. Plus 6. Because in each of the cases here, each bond is, the outside atom is more electronegative. So if you have 6 bonds that pull away 6 electrons, that effectively makes a plus 6 oxidation state. If you are familiar with the movie Aaron Brockovich about PG&E and chromium poisoning, that's the hexavalent chromium that they refer to in that movie. Sorry, PG&E. Hey. Truth is truth. Past is past. Reason for showing you that plus 6 oxidation state, oh, I shouldn't have used red, oh well, is because that means that chromium really likes to get electrons. Chromium makes a good oxidizing agent, but good oxidizing agents are ones that therefore in turn get reduced. That which oxidizes and pulls electrons away itself is gaining those electrons and becoming reduced. So there'll be one key reaction step coming up where chromium gets electrons and it's the driving force for this reaction. To anticipate a concern that comes up in this class, and somehow this year it was more eloquently expressed in a question that someone asked this morning, is as I write this mechanism, do you have to worry about which steps are reversible and which ones are not? Yes. But that can be frustrating because this oxidation overall is not really reversible. But there are aspects of it, individual portions of it that might be reversible. Do you have to know when to switch back and forth between the arrows then? It'd be better if you did, but I'm going to say no. I'm going to say it this way, that if an overall reaction is principally irreversible, then unless it really matters, I'm going to allow you to just use forward arrows for those kinds of reactions. If you had something like the PODE mechanism, protonate, open attack, deprotonate, some situation which is truly entirely reversible, then yes, you need to know that you use reversible arrows for each of those mechanism steps. Because I just stated that this reaction is in principle not reversible, then I'm going to allow you to just use forward arrows for this reaction. Now let me change this color, in fact, so we don't get our mechanism arrows confused. Because, like the reaction of thionyl chloride and tosyl chloride, what do you think the first reaction step is going to be in this case? You know, instead of just blindly memorizing our flashcards, let's use the patterns we're learning, see if we can predict what the first step will be. Someone want to suggest what the first step of this reaction would be?
Right, because chromium
has got this plus six oxidation state. It's got all this electronegative stuff around it to make it really delta positive. And so just like tosyl chloride, thionyl chloride, oxygen's going to attack it. Now, I made this statement when I showed you that mechanism step before, that way that I opened the carbonyl and then at the same time showed that carbonyl closing was just one way to write that reaction. I'm going to show you a second way to do it today. I'm going to say this again because in all three sections, what happened is later on someone asked, why are you doing it that way? Because as we'll learn in the future, one reaction does not necessarily happen by just one mechanism. And there's evidence for some of these different ways that I'm showing you how to write the mechanism. So don't worry which is the right answer, because there is not the right answer. There's different ways to write it. Don't worry about why am I showing it one way versus the other, because all I'm doing at the moment is exposing you to the fact that there's sometimes multiple mechanisms. Later on, you will understand why I've showed you these different routes. So focus more on the end result. Don't get too caught up in this one difference. But do realize I am showing you that difference to make you aware of a more sophisticated topic coming in the future. So I'm going to show it like this. Oxygen attacks chromium. Chromium-oxygen bond opens up. I'll show the subsequent reformation of that carbonyl separately this time. That's the difference between how I'm showing this and what I showed for thionyl and tosyl chlorides previously. Now notice the abbreviation. Since you've shown me pyridinium once, since I showed you pyridinium once, I'm going to just abbreviate it thereafter. And that's exactly what you can do on your assessments. That's our teacher speak for quizzes and exams. So what happens next? You have this negative charge on two different oxygens. You got to think, well, maybe one or the other is going to want to attack chromium again because chromium wouldn't mind having electrons. When it does, chlorine is a good leaving group, and so chloride can get kicked off. We still have an excess charge because oxygen had been neutral, and so we'll have a deprotonation. This is exactly that case of, well, wait, what do I do with the type of arrow I use to represent this? Do I use a reversible arrow? Do I use a forward arrow? Recognize that all protonations and deprotonations are, in theory, reversible. So every time you have a hydrogen falling off like this, you should be using a reversible arrow. But why am I showing a forward arrow then? Well, because that's extremely acidic. So it's going to be in equilibrium, but it's going to be 99.999% shifted to the right. So that's my weak justification for using a forward arrow to simplify our lives a little bit. Any of you that are chem majors, which I think I asked that during the opening week, who my people are here, but where are my peeps? Where are my chem majors? We got some in here. Okay, so then this thing about whether you use reversible or non-reversible arrows, just remember, you're going to have a future instructor that's probably going to be a lot fussier than me about it. So, once it falls off, we have this intermediate, which allow me to show you another kind of intermediate. First, I'll start out with a carboxylic acid. So notice that has a carbonyl to which is attached an OH group. There is a type of reaction that you'll learn next quarter where we can convert that into this kind of molecule, in which the OH has been replaced by an OR, you could say. This second type of molecule, well, let me ask, does anybody recognize what functional group that is? It is an ester. And let me just point out, it is not the biblical spelling, it's without the H-E-S-T-E-R. That's a carbon ester, a carbonyl ester. Notice the similarity between that and what we just generated up above. That here we also have that effectively OR group attached to not a carbonyl, I don't know if that's called a chromonyl or what, but that chromium oxygen motif. This thing is called a chromate ester. Similarly, when we used a sulfonyl chloride, tosyl chloride, to make a leaving group, that was making a sulfonate ester. At some point I'll write that term down, but just in case you had seen that in your text, that's what it was referring to. Having the sulfur being the center with an OR group attached. It is at this point the unusual reactivity occurs, what the oxidation step itself now happens. Because a hydrogen that is attached to the same carbon as the what had been the alcohol will now get attacked by a base. If I am myself not worrying about what that base is, then you don't worry about what that base is for the moment. Unless you really are curious, but I don't want to get bogged down in that discussion. Some kind of base comes along, pulls a hydrogen off. The carbon-hydrogen bond that had been there goes to the oxygen. Question came up this morning. Do I write it to the bond in between the carbon and the oxygen, or do I write it to the oxygen itself? In my mind, it's the same thing. You're making a new connection. So whether you're showing it to the bond or to the atom, if you're showing it to the atom, you are making a bond. But oxygen is normally divalent, so something gives. And it would be the chromium oxygen bond. Formally, those two electrons are explicitly coming to chromium now. And therefore, chromium's gaining electrons. It's becoming reduced in its oxidation state. Let me point that out. Chromium's reduced. Carbon is oxidized. What's the end result? An aldehyde. Plus, things happen to the chromium reagent afterwards. Some instructors, some texts get all hot and bothered about what is going to happen to that chromium. I don't care for the level of this class. Again, a chem major, you'd go into that cycle of further reaction. For this class, don't need to know it. So what I've just shown you is a reaction to convert a primary alcohol into an aldehyde. Now, given the time, this is the perfect pause point, so let's go ahead and pause here, take our short break. But before I do, are there any questions about this first mechanism? Yes?
About the other parts of it, so can OH plus there deprotonate first before that happens?
Possibly. The question is really... that's being asked is, will the elimination of this chlorine or will the deprotonation of that hydrogen occur first? I could try to look it up. I don't know if it matters which one happens first. I'm going to go out on a limb and just say, since these aren't resonant structures per se, these are reaction steps, I would guess that either could happen in either order, but I'll try to clarify that if I can find that. Unlikely to coordinate that many molecules in that. No, fair question, but unlikely to happen simultaneously. Other questions? So, if for quiz purposes, if you had primary alcohol, PCC, no water, you'd need to be able to write this mechanism and show what results, yes. And that you stop at the aldehyde. What happens if you do have water? This will be the cliffhanger. This will be for season two, where we'll find that out right after the break. Continuing our story of chromium oxidation, we had just seen how PCC could be used to selectively oxidize a primary alcohol up to an aldehyde. Now let's see what would happen if we did have aqueous conditions. Now I've mentioned previously how PCC in and of itself is not just the key part of it, it is the fact that we have anhydrous conditions. If we had water, we could still use PCC, but it would not have the selectivity of what I had just shown you. Now, before I show you the mechanism itself, let me make a comment about equilibrium. Because last quarter, for those of you who are new to me, we did have a discussion of kinetics, thermodynamics, and equilibrium, a review from the Chem-1 sequence. And much of what we focused on for equilibrium was reversibility, the fact there is this thing called an equilibrium constant, and then we talked about energy differences being the motivator for a chemical reaction. But I want to put a little spin, a little different emphasis on it today. Because what I want to say is this, that if an equilibrium can occur, it will occur, even if the products that are formed are not favorable. Because even if you weren't with me last quarter, you must have heard that equilibrium, one of its definitions, is that it's a dynamic process in which the forward and reverse rates of that process are equal to each other. When a chemical reaction, you can't have a reverse reaction unless you have product. And if you only have a forward reaction, that means you're going to make product. So if you have the environment in which a reversible reaction can be established, it will establish equilibrium, which means you're going to make a little tiny bit of the product, even if it's just a handful of molecules. The key here is that imagine we have this aldehyde. We learned 2 weeks ago that an aldehyde in the presence of water can form something called a hydrate. Hydrates have OH groups, and so what if you have this chromium reagent, you've made the aldehyde, but you have water. The water can cause the formation of a hydrate, which makes an OH group, which can react with the chromium again. And that's exactly what happens. So let me make this statement again about equilibrium. And I'll say it much the same way. If an equilibrium can be established, it will be established. Meaning there will always be some non-zero quantity of products. Even if the formation of products is not favorable. Now, what is going to occur? Well, as I indicated a moment ago, we're going to form a hydrate. So let's remind ourselves of how that mechanism works. There is this mnemonic that I had come up with, PODE, protonate open attack deprotonate. So the first step of that is for the carbonyl to become protonated. Reversibly, that is key. Then you end up with a delocalized ion that we can show formally using resonance structures. And so in this case, we'll have the carbonyl open, generates a carbocation that then can be attacked by water. So that's the attack. Again, reversible formation. I'm going to drop the hydrogen I've been explicitly writing because there's not really a need to carry it any further. And after the addition of water, we'll have a deprotonation step. And actually, I'm going to take that back. I'm going to write that hydrogen in. You'll see why momentarily. So, we have the hydrate, which is a geminal alcohol. Geminal meaning twin, meaning the two OH groups are located on the same carbon. More importantly, we have OH groups, which this means it can react with the chromium, and another round of oxidation could occur. It might turn out to be the case that on an exam or quiz, I phrase the question in such a way that you don't have to write the full mechanism a second time. But I'm going to do it once anyways, just so we had done it for completion's sake once. Now I'm going to come back one last time to make a commentary about the use of PCC in this case, but what I'm showing you here is, imagine that we did the oxidation we saw previously. We had PCC, primary alcohol, end up with an aldehyde. Let's say we have water around, which means we still have PCC around. So again, I'm not advising we use PCC in this case, but this is what would happen if you had water sneak in accidentally. The same cycle occurs. Oxygen from one of the alcohols, doesn't matter which, attacks the chromium. I'm showing this particular alcohol because it's going to give me a carbonyl oriented the way that I normally write carbonyls. It's the only reason I chose that one. Notice I'm remembering my pyridinium. If you've got a negative charge, you have to have a counter ion with it, so don't forget to write this pyridine plus. After that initial attack, we have lots of stuff hooked up to that chromium. Which, sorry, it's a little crowded, but I think you can see what's going on. Let me make a little dividing line there. So one or the other oxygens attacks the chromium, kicking the chlorine off. Oops, I skipped a step accidentally. I'm just demonstrating what not to do. Make sure you do show the separate step of the deprotonation of the oxonium ion occurring. So now we end up with the chromate ester. And now, I think I said this, Here's why I wrote that hydrogen in. Because if you didn't have that hydrogen, the one I just wrote in, no elimination could occur. You would not be able to further unsaturate the molecule. Because we have that removable hydrogen, it will get removed, which, just as before, will come back and force the oxygen-chromium bond to break towards the chromium, causing the reduction of the chromium, the oxidation of the carbon, and resulting in a carboxylic acid. So, in the presence of water, a primary alcohol will over-oxidize to a carboxylic acid. Which, under normal conditions, won't react any further. Now, if you really were on top of your game over the break meaning when I wasn't here, you'll know there's other oxidizing reagents that don't just specifically act necessarily on a functional group. They're not as clean as just taking an oxygen-carbon single bond and making it a double bond. In some cases, we're going to learn that oxidizing agents can cause the cleavage of carbon-carbon bonds. But those forms of extraordinarily aggressive oxidation are not what we're discussing here. So when I say that this can't be oxidized any further, yeah, give a powerful enough reagent, you can make this do something. But that's not the situation we're talking about. Using the normal chromium reagents, nothing else happens here for two reasons. One, there is no more hydrogen at that position to be able to eliminate to cause another double bond or to form. So even if somehow we could attack that carbon and put more water on there, because you can make what's called an orthoacid, meaning you have three OH groups on one carbon, but none of them will get oxidized. Why? Because if we had some regular oxidation reagent, and let's say we tried to imagine that we got another carbonyl somehow. Notice that that means five bonds to carbon, which means it's not going to react any further. So, PCC, no water. Primary alcohol can go to a aldehyde. PCC or any chromium reagent with water. Over-oxidation is going to occur to make a carboxylic acid. When you do want to oxidize like this, we don't use PCC, we use a form of chromium trioxide. So when aqueous conditions are used, aqueous chromium trioxide is used instead of PCC. So I don't remember the cost difference now, but it's a heck of a lot cheaper to use chromium trioxide. PCC we only use, this will be the last time I say it for now, we only use that when you have anhydrous conditions, because that's the advantage that combination of no water and PCC gives you. You can stop at the aldehyde. Now, a mixture of a trace amount of sulfuric acid, water, and then chromium trioxide, mix that together, that's called the Jones reagent. And you might see that referred to in some places. And I'll do an example mechanism with the chromium trioxide some other time. Hadn't done it for the other sections yet, so when we review oxidation, I'll show you this. It's going to act almost identically to the PCC mechanism, but just to not confuse us at the moment, that's why I'm skipping it just for now. Questions over oxidation of primary alcohols. Yes.
Does that have something to do with the oxidation of the alcohol to, I mean, something like beer to oxidize to become carboxylic acid?
So you're talking about the metabolic pathway, what occurs? You know, I'm fortunately never taken biochemistry. I do know something about the consumption of alcohol does involve forming oxidation products, and I believe what ends up causing the hangover, lack of water to form hydrates out of the aldehydes or ketones that form for them to be further metabolized. I think that's where the problem is. So that's why if you don't consume water at the time, you end up with the bad result because you cause the decomposition of it to be slowed down. How exactly that occurs or what really the intermediates are, should ask your biology instructors, unfortunately. Other questions about oxidation of primary alcohols? I will say that as an anecdotal story that I never verified or followed up on because I was no way in the world I was going to try it myself, I've been told that the human body can metabolize all sorts of even-numbered carbon alcohols, not just the ethanol that is in alcohol. So there must be some kind of enzyme or something that acts on two carbon units. But that's as much as it as I'll say no, and I don't really know it because I never took a course on it. Let's move on to secondary alcohols then, if we got primary alcohols under control. Secondary alcohols can only be oxidized to ketones. And again, this is presuming that we're using an oxidizing agent that is specific to oxidizing alcohols and won't just rip the entire molecule apart. Why is this true? Well, let's take something like isopropanol. Notice it only has one hydrogen attached to the same carbon that the OH group is attached to. That means, again, if we use oxidative conditions, we're able to pull that hydrogen off to make a carbonyl. But if we tried to then oxidize at that point, we run into the same two problems. There's no hydrogen on that carbon removed, and even if somehow we forced an OH group on there to make it look like a carboxylic acid, again, it won't happen because we have five bonds to carbon. So you can use PCC, but there's no reason to. Use the cheaper, more brutal reagent because you can't go past the ketone anyways. With that in mind, let's just go ahead and go on to tertiary alcohols. So one last time, that same disclaimer. Other than reagents that are just going to totally mangle this molecule, if we use something like chromium trioxide in water, no reaction for exactly the same two reasons. There's no hydrogen. And if we tried to make the product, we'd have five bonds to carbon. Now, there is another form of oxidation we will discuss later on, the Swern oxidation, which I believe that's located in the later chapters that were under the sections for this topic. So we'll come back to it, but for right now, focusing just on the chromium oxidation, and even more importantly than that, that is the end of the lecture information for quiz number one. Which means, yes, anything else I say today is on the exam, but not on the quiz. So last chance for questions on the chromium topic before we move on. Okay, then our next topic is going to be on epoxides. Because they have a different reactivity than other ethers. So an epoxide is nothing more than a specific kind of cyclic ether. Where you have two carbons that are both spanned by the same oxygen. That's a three-membered ring that's strained. It can be formed. They are common functional groups, but they're just reactive functional groups. Last quarter, we used two methods to synthesize these. So now, new students, how many of you have not heard of MCPBA? Any of you new students have not heard of MCPBA? Have you heard of MMPP? Okay, those are the two acronyms for the reagents that are most commonly presented. You might have even learned a general reagent to use. But if you didn't learn either, then learn the MCPBA I'm about to show you, because that's the one that all the returning students learned last quarter. So we'll start with that. MCPBA, I actually presented that on the first day when we went over some of the exams from the answers from the final, which that reminds me, if you haven't done so, if you would please, those of you who were here last quarter, you would please go ahead and photocopy or review your finals and bring those so you can turn those back in on Wednesday. MCPBA, meta chloro peroxy benzoic acid. So benzoic acid would be a benzene ring with just a COOH group. Peroxy means you throw an additional oxygen in there. Meta is two positions away. We're going to discuss these terms, ortho, meta, para, and ipso, just a few weeks. But there's our meta. In general, it does not actually matter that we have the benzene ring. What you have to have is this peroxy acid. The reason we do have these two specific reagents that are normally used is because peroxy acids have this bad habit of exploding. Because of the oxygen-oxygen single bond. It is a weak bond, and these compounds decompose. My recollection is that they're shock hazards. So give a good sharp jolt to the reaction flask and, well, boom. But this is somewhat more stable, so that's why we use it. How does it react? It's essentially the oxygen adding into the double bond and forming one of those ring-type structures, a little bit like the way that we did with mercury and bromine last quarter. In fact, when I show you how this epoxide behaves, how it reacts, there's going to be some very direct parallels between its reactivity and the cyclobromonium and cyclomercurinium ions that we saw last quarter. So, not getting too far ahead of myself here, what is the reaction mechanism that occurs? Complicated. Because this is what's known as a pericyclic reaction. Meaning that in some sense, there's electrons that are going to be traveling around as if they were traveling in a circle. That's one thing that's going on. At the same time, you've got oxygen interacting with this double bond. So whether you express it as the double bond attacking oxygen because that oxygen-oxygen bond easily breaks, or whether you have oxygen attacking the double bond, it kind of doesn't matter. And I guess I didn't have my background part of my brain working well up this morning because I didn't present it in the order that I did last quarter. Just kind of froze up and forgot. So they got the right mechanism, but let me tell the story a little differently for you all. Because it does focus in on the fact that oxygen-oxygen bond is weak. And so let's have the alkene attack that oxygen first,
causing the oxygen-oxygen bond to break.
Now, the electrons could simply settle on the oxygen, but that's a delocalized ion. If you have a negative charge oxygen right next to carbonyl, you're going to have resonance that occurs. So instead of just showing the electrons arriving at and staying on the oxygen, I'm going to show them delocalizing.
By pushing open the carbonyl.
When that carbonyl opens, we have a negatively charged oxygen. Well, this had been a peroxy acid, meaning that the hydrogen at the end could come off.
So imagine that that carbonyl grabs a hydrogen. Well, that pair of electrons has to go somewhere. It falls back to the oxygen, which therefore can attack
back towards the alkene. So notice there's a cyclic portion of this mechanism, and then there's the fact that the oxygen sits down on that alkene.
What you get are three things. You get two epoxides, at least in this case, because the double bond had been flat. And so that means that the reagent could have attacked from either face of the double bond,
which means in cases like this where you have asymmetric products, you're going to end up with enantiomers. The other thing you end up with
is the byproduct benzoic acid, which we don't care about, but just want to mention.
That's one way to make an epoxide, using MCPBA. We learned a second way last quarter, didn't we? Didn't we? Do we remember last quarter? Well, let me refresh your memory.
To do so, I'm going to do one of my common favorite tricks, which is to add a deuterium.
Now recognize, deuterium's just a form of hydrogen. So once that becomes unsaturated, this is going to be a primary carbon. Don't count the D as an R group, because it's not. It's just a special form of hydrogen. But I'm doing this to ensure that we end up with stereocenters at both carbons once we have our product, to help show what happens stereochemically in this reaction.
So
anybody that happens to remember, what is the first set of reagents that we use here? Ooh. The only reason I'm surprised that you don't remember is the 7:30 class that hadn't had the caffeine to survive the day yet, or just had it, they came up with the answer. No, that's for reduction, but good guess. What we make is a halohydrin, bromine and water.
I haven't had a chance to look it up yet, but for the new students, there is a lecture last quarter where we went over this mechanism. I will not review the mechanism this quarter because we've been shortchanged on time. So returning students, you need to go find it in your notes. New students, if you're not familiar with the product from this, either come ask me about it, or the 12A notes are all still posted from last quarter, and one of your classmates could probably help you locate which day this reaction was done on. The result is going to be a bromohydrin, meaning that we have a bromine and an OH group right next door to each other. The key, one of the key aspects of this reaction is the addition on the double bond occurs with anti-addition. So the OH group that results, which the OH group does go to the more substituted position, that's the Markovnikov product, it's going to be pointed the opposite direction of the halogen that ends up on there.
Notice that means that these two groups could be, even in a ring situation, in the anti-periplanar configuration that we need for elimination to occur. So the second step of this reaction,
boy, I'm not giving enough room to myself today, am I? Second part of this reaction is for sodium hydride to be used, to make an alkoxide. That's a reaction we formally learned this quarter. And if you have the alkoxide pointed one way and the leaving group pointed the other, SN2 can happen. Just happens to be intramolecular SN2. Now let me add one detail to what I've done so far. In both of these cases, we're going to end up with an antimers. Again, because the original double bond was flat. Just as I use this abbreviation here, I could use that same abbreviation, or just as I use this abbreviation here, you may use the same approach on your quizzes and exams. In other words, instead of carrying a bunch of structures around on paper, if you know that there's going to be an antimer, you can simply state as much. So the product's going to be a pair of epoxides. So this is just review. How do we synthesize? And there was a related question that came up on the quiz. Do you have to know all of your 12A material for this quiz? Well, in some senses, yes. In some senses, no. Because the question really was more, are we going to have a bunch of synthesis problems on the quiz? And I thought about it, and I gave an answer that sounded kind of like this. That so far this quarter, we've been mostly focused on mechanism. That we've learned several new reactions that we've learned the mechanism for. And we've also learned several new reagents. So it seems to be, it would make more sense that if I was going to ask something on a quiz that more matches what we've done in lecture, that I would ask heavily questions about mechanism and fill-in-the-blank type problems. Neither of which requires you knowing all of the reagents for all the reactions from last quarter. Another way I'll put it is, I never did tack on that extra sheet of the list of the reactions from last quarter that you need to know, and so it wouldn't really be all that fair for me to suddenly ask a whole bunch of questions about synthesis on the quiz, unless they were all just this material, this quarter's material. So I'll say the words mechanism and fill in the blank again and see if you all are picking up on the subtle hint or not. So, no, you don't have to go back and relearn all your 12A for this quiz, but by the time we get to the exam, you better make sure that you've reviewed it a little bit for the purposes of doing synthesis, not necessarily mechanism. Now, what I want to wrap up with epoxides is to show you two examples of the ways in which epoxides react. That is all the time we had for the morning section for us to get through. So, yes, that does mean you're going to get out a little earlier today. But that means we'll pick up with epoxides and ethers in lecture on Wednesday after the quiz. So now what are we going to do next? We're going to explore the fact that because this is a strained three-membered ring, it can be opened. And it can be opened under two different sets of conditions. Cationic, which means generally acidic conditions, or anionic, which means generally basic conditions. So first we're going to do cationic acid catalyzed ring opening. And we could, for example, do something like this. I'm going to take the same generalized chiral epoxide that I just generated, the one that has the deuterium. And let's say that I react it with ethanol and TSOH. What does the TSOH stand for? Tosic acid. Is any portion of the tosic acid going to remain on the molecule after this reaction is over? More specifically, is the tosylate portion of the acid in any way going to end up on our product molecule? No, but it is one of the most common wrong answers that I see when I put toxic acid down, because if you don't remember what the structure is, you think, wait, this has got to go somewhere. And so the answer is people try to stuff that into the product. It doesn't work that way. Remember that tosic acid is this organic, soluble, easily handleable, cheap, solid, that's a strong acid, and that the conjugate is not nucleophilic. If it's not nucleophilic, it's not going to react. So it is only here as a source of H+. So what does happen? Well, the alcohol is not a good nucleophile. It's a weak nucleophile. So even though the ring is strained, alcohol alone won't do it. That's why we have the acid catalyst. So the first step of the reaction is, in fact, for the oxygen of the epoxide to get protonated. Quite technically, I could call this a cyclooxonium ion. Oxonium is that word we've already seen that means positively charged oxygen. Cyclo means cyclic. What other intermediates from what reactions last quarter does this look an awful lot like then? Where have you seen reactions before that had some three-atom ring with a positive charge on one of the atoms of that ring? Oxymercuration, where we had the mercury that was positively charged. That's the cyclomercurinium ion. What other reaction? Right, the cyclobromonium ion, where we have Br2. In fact, that's what you form in the first step of this Br2 in water. You form a cyclobromonium ion. The reason I'm bringing this up is because if you had something like this, we have a primary versus a secondary carbon. The bond from oxygen is weaker to which of those two positions, the primary or the secondary? I'll ask the question again because it was a little complicated in its wording. If one of the two bonds in that ring is going to break, which one's going to break more easily? The bond of the secondary carbon, why? Because if we formed a carbocation, which we don't in this reaction, but if the ring popped open by itself, it would make sense that it would form the positive charge on the secondary position instead of the primary. Well, and that's because of hyperconjugation. If that's true, if it's easier to form the carbocation on the secondary position, that means that the bond to the secondary position is weaker and longer. And therefore, that's why what breaks, breaks. This is another one of those subtopics. Those of you who are new, you need to go back to the bromine and mercury reactions of Chem 12A, review the intermediate, because exactly the same long paragraph that's there about how it reacts is 100% applicable in this case. But I'll write a brief summary of it here. To say the bond going to the secondary position, that's what I mean by this. This bond is longer and weaker because if it broke on its own, a more stabilized carbocation would form. But I'll say, if it broke on its own, it doesn't. It's exactly the same as in those mercury and bromine intermediates. Something comes along and pops the ring open. The reason that's important is because that means stereochemistry is specific. You're going to have inversion of configuration occur wherever the alcohol attacks. So now let's show the alcohol attacking, which pushes the ring open. So the acid catalyst helps destabilize it more, makes the three-membered ring even less favorable.
It allows something to be, attack it and push it open, therefore, but that attack and opening is concerted, which is why you end up with inversion of configuration at that point. So initially, Gesundheit again. So initially we have a positive charged intermediate, which deprotonates. And we end up with a molecule that has both alcohol and ether functionality. But notice that the reaction under cationic conditions ends up putting the ether at the more substituted position. Questions about the cationic ring opening then? Well, then I'll show you the last one for today, which is the anionic ring opening. Now, we're going to have to review both of these cases because there's some other reagents I need to show you, and I want to really drive in this difference in regiochemistry that occurs whether you use cationic or anionic reagents. So this is going to be anionic, and it's not base catalyzed. See, it's called acid catalyzed because notice that the last step, we get the H plus back. Technically, it's the same H plus. No, it's not. It's a different H plus than what we started with. So that's why I rephrase my question about tosic acid. The only thing from tosic acid that might get incorporated is the H plus itself. But base promoted, that's the phrase we use because the base is going to end up part of the product. So starting with that same chiral alcohol, and I'm sorry, I forgot to write the header here, anionic base promoted ring opening. For the cationic version, we use a weak nucleophile, a neutral one. For the anionic, the basic one, we're going to use an ionic nucleophile, an alkoxide. A strong enough base is able to open the epoxide all by itself. But where do you think the attack's going to occur this time? On the more or the less substituted position? Less. Because since there is nothing else further destabilizing the ring, this really turns into a question of kinetics. This is very, very much like a plain old SN2 reaction. We're just using an unusual form of leaving group. Oxygen's being a leaving group, but only because of the three-membered ring. So the primary position is less sterically hindered. And so the attack is going to happen at the primary position. This is again concerted, meaning the ring opens the same time the attack occurs. So it's not that this is SN2 and the first one was SN1. No, but that would be a reasonable parallel to expect because SN1 is a cationic process, SN2 is an anionic process. So if I say SN2 here, it would have made sense you thought SN1 previously. But the stereochemistry is inverted with cationic conditions. So just make sure that you don't automatically assign one as SN2, SN1. Here, because the attack is again simultaneous, we again have inversion of configuration, but because the primary position is less sterically hindered, it's the one that gets attacked, which means two things. One, that's the one where the inversion of stereochemistry occurs. But two, that means that the ether that forms is going to be at the less substituted position now.
Now, if we had no further reagents, this is where we would end up potentially. So there is a second step that when we write this out synthetically that we must include. And so normally I wouldn't write anything that looks like synthesis while writing a mechanism, but I want to highlight the fact that I'm going to switch to acidic conditions. You might remember that earlier in the quarter I already made the comment, don't mix your acids and bases, because if you do, they'll just neutralize each other. So in the process of writing a mechanism, if you start with H+, you never can write an OH minus. If you start with OH minus, you can never write OH plus. Did I say OH plus? Wait, for those that know the quote, strike it, reverse it. But you have to put in a 2 here, meaning you have to. Anybody know what that quote was I just said? You all are too young or I'm too old. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory? Anybody even know what that is? Okay, a few people. I know. Old school, right? Ancient school. No. I'm coming up on one of my decade birthdays soon, so I've been thinking that on my own already. I could list 20 musicians, I bet, if I named y'all go, who? What? Oh, yeah, we read that in a history book once. Anyway, back to this. You have to put the 2 in to show that you're going from basic. Recognize that that's an alkoxide. That's a base, so there's no H plus around. No appreciable, usable quantity of H plus in solution. So if I want to write H plus, I've got to put the 2 there. Since I have put the 2 there, now it's okay for me to write H plus to get us to our product, which again has both alcohol and ether functionality. It's just that the regiochemistry has been inverted. So are there any questions about the anionic ring opening? Or backtracking, has anybody come up with any extra questions for the cationic ring opening? Then, for Wednesday, we will have the most minimal of lab lectures. I'll spend maybe 5 minutes total talking about setup and safety because this is such a straightforward reaction. I know that you have not finished the previous reaction. My hope is that we will learn how to multitask like a true lab chemist would. In other words, it's extraordinarily rare that a chemist would ever just set up one reaction, sit around waiting for it to occur, and then, okay, it's done, so now I can do a second reaction. No. You get one going, and then you multitask. You get another one going. So we'll have very brief lab lecture Wednesday, but otherwise we're going to straight into lab. So that's it for today.